Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. With all of us now so connected in this digital world, the question of cybersecurity becomes increasingly important. Whether it's protecting our cell phones or national security, we want information protected. The increasing number of data breaches at the supermarket or the Pentagon would indicate we've got a long way to go. President Obama has just asked for a big increase in cybersecurity spending, and we're happy to welcome back in studio our homegrown ethical hacker, Charlie Miller. Charlie and other cybersecurity experts are working with business, industry, and government to plug vulnerabilities. Charlie holds a PhD in mathematics from Notre Dame. He's worked for Twitter and before that the National Security Agency, the NSA. He now works with Uber. Charlie Miller, welcome. Nice to have you back again.
Thanks for having me.
Do you mind being called a hacker? There is a pejorative context there.
There is. I don't mind too much. The term we usually use is security researcher, which kind of differentiates it, I think. The phrase ethical hacker, like, I don't really care for too much because you don't call your doctor an ethical doctor or your banker an ethical banker. You just sort of assume they're good. So I think it kind of puts the problem on us. So, security researcher, hacker, whatever. I know I'm the good guy, so that's all.
We'll go with the security expert.
That's fine.
In that case. It's been two and a half years since you were last here. How far have we come, do you think, in terms of dealing with the vulnerabilities on our personal devices, what have you, and in the national scene?
2 years is not much time in this field, so I don't think there's been too much progress. Things are incrementally better, but if anything, if you look at some of the research I've done with the vehicles lately, it's almost worse than it's ever been. So there's more and more code, more and more problems, and the same amount of people trying to fix it.
Well, that's one of the things we talked about last time, was the fact that hackers, the bad guys, can actually affect the performance of our cars as they're driving down the highway. So what is your research showing today?
Right. So last time I was here, I was showing that if someone could somehow get code running in your car, they could control some of the systems like the steering and the braking. But last time I was limited to where I would have to be physically plugged into the car. Since then, last summer, myself and my research partner, Chris Valsek, showed you could actually do it remotely. So we were able to scan the internet, find a bunch of Fiat Chrysler vehicles, and we could have just broken into those and then affected the steering and the braking and the radio and anything else we wanted to. So it was really scary. The good news is they fixed that flaw, and they recalled 1.4 million vehicles to get everything fixed up. So we don't. That's one less bug we have to worry about. But there's no reason to think that there's not a plethora of other vulnerabilities in other cars.
And with the autonomous car en route, does that create a bigger potential problem for you?
Well, I think if you look even at the Jeep I had and the testing I did, it's not autonomous, but it has a lot of autonomous features. So it can keep you in your lane. It has this feature called Lane Keep Assist. If it detects you're going to crash, it can apply the brakes. It can have cruise control, of course, but it also has cruise control called adaptive cruise control, which allows you to slow down if you're approaching another car and all the way to a stop and speed you back up. So there's a lot of autonomous features even in our everyday cars now, and all of those features are things that attackers can take advantage of. So if there's a computer that can apply your brakes, that means there's a bad guy. If a bad guy gets in, he can apply your brakes, and if there's a computer that can control your steering, likewise.
Why would somebody want to do that? I mean, it doesn't make any sense.
It's a good question. So a lot of the reasons that you see hackers doing things are financially motivated. So they're trying to steal credit cards, or they're trying to encrypt all your files and make you pay them to get it out. And so far, there's not really, at least to me, an obvious financial benefit from attacking vehicles. It's really hard, and I don't see there's not much payout for that. So hopefully that's something we won't see. My job is to make sure it never happens. I'm trying to stay ahead of the game instead of waiting for a bunch of cars to get hacked and stop it after that.
So how do you go about that?
Well, if I worked for Ford or Toyota or something, I would have a direct impact on that. But since I don't, I can't tell them how to make their cars. What I've done is just try to raise awareness by demonstrating these flaws in vehicles. In particular, I've found one certain flaw that allowed us to remotely get into cars. And that one is fixed because I reported it and told them how to fix it.
But this is something that a smart kid could probably do. I mean, I have a note here saying that they could adjust the volume on your radio driving past, that sort of thing.
Well, yeah. So car hacking is a little harder than, say, hacking your PC, because everyone has, well, most people have the same computer, essentially a Windows computer or something, or the same kind of phone. But every car is a little bit different. And so if my particular attack only worked against particular Fiat Chrysler vehicles. But so that makes it kind of hard, because if you then had a Ford or something else, I wouldn't have been able to attack you. So, and it's expensive. You have to have a car. You know, most teenage hackers don't have access to a car, and at least not a car they're willing to kind of damage in testing. So car hacking is harder than other kinds of things, but it's still the impact is so much larger, right? If the worst thing that can happen is someone steals your photos, or maybe steals your bank account, like, that's really bad. But if someone's crashing cars, it's so much more intense.
This is how you make your living, people, companies that have issues that they want to be sure that they can protect, hire a Charlie Miller and say, help me protect myself?
Not really. This is more of a hobby. So I do work full time for a company, Uber, and I help them secure, their software and everything. And, that's a job. But all this stuff with the vehicle hacking, and in the past I've hacked iPhones and laptops and everything else, most of that I just do because it's interesting and I want to help. And some people do crossword puzzles. I find vulnerabilities in software.
I suspect, though, that companies, I'll just use a local example, Schnucks, when they had the problem, they probably hired someone like you, someone with your abilities, to figure out how to keep that from happening again.
Definitely. So for many years, I guess, 5 or 6 years, I was a consultant, and I was hired for those types of things exactly, because you can't really expect Schnucks to keep a top-tier cybersecurity team on duty all the time, right? It's not really practical. So it's nice to have consultants who are experts come in, make sure things are okay once in a while, and then if there's a problem, they can obviously come in and help with that too.
Is it possible to make any system 100% hack-proof?
Definitely not. So
encouraging.
Well, it is. Yeah. So no matter what, no matter how much money you spend, how many resources you put into it, this is software and hardware made by people, and we're not perfect and we make mistakes. So despite your best efforts, there's always going to be some sort of, subtle flaw, probably, right? Maybe someday we'll do it. But for now, everything we have is millions of lines of code. It's very complex. No one understands it all. And so there's usually going to be some problem that is there that eventually will be found by somebody.
In his most recent budget proposal, President Obama has requested $19 billion specifically for cybersecurity. What can we get for $19 billion if nothing is totally hack-proof?
Well, he could hire me for that. I'd be willing to do that. But really, it's tough. So he has an extremely difficult job. So if you think about your typical company trying to keep out hackers, the types of hackers they're trying to keep out are maybe, bored teenagers or people trying to deface their website for fun. And maybe a more advanced company like an Edward Jones or something, they're maybe trying to keep out, professional hackers that are on the scale of, Russian mafia or something, right? But if you think about a government computer, they're trying to keep out other governments, so Chinese governments and Russian governments, and they have, nearly unlimited resources and talent and time, and trying to keep out those kind of attackers is almost impossible. So if you look at if you're a local cybersecurity person and you're working for Edward Jones or something, and you don't even have to consider those types of attacks because it's just too hard and you don't have the resources for it. And so for the government to try to come in and secure their computers is just, it's just exponentially harder than anyone else has to deal with.
What I'd look at is the fact that the government had so much trouble establishing the Obamacare health site. It was just fraught with all sorts of problems. Mm-hmm. To think the government can now, clean up the whole thing.
No, it's a mess, right? Yeah. So they don't have the people to do it, which is the main problem. And no matter how much money you have, if you don't have experts and people to help you, it's not going to work. And, right now, the government. I used to work for the government. The government doesn't pay as much as the private sector, so you've got that problem. And in my hacker culture, or whatever, it's not really seen to be cool to work for the government. And so there's a lot of problems we're going to have getting people, and they're way behind. So it's going to be a lot of catch up time, and they have a lot of systems. And I already mentioned the attackers that are going to target them are worse than anyone that you or I are going to have to worry about.
I've read and heard it said that the next war is probably going to be a cyber war. Would you buy that?
I'm sure there'll be components of that. I think that eventually, if you want to, you know, attack someone, you're going to have to bring in some troops at some point. But I certainly think that if you think about just in our weaponry, how much is electronic and how much that is a problem. But like our power, you know, our banking, everything is electronic. And so if you can affect that, then you might not need to launch as many missiles as you might have had to in the past.
What about the grid?
The power grid?
Yeah.
I don't know. So it's something we obviously depend on. It's supposed to be isolated from the internet, but there's many cases that historically have shown that it's not. And most of these computers are very old, and you don't want to really mess with them, right? Everything works, so why change it? And they're old systems, and so they're vulnerable, and you know, we don't really know. So hopefully. You know, it's a problem, and I don't really know. I don't think anyone really knows how to get started on solving it.
You're not the things that you're saying are not encouraging me very much about the potential out there for more than malicious activity.
Yeah, I mean, the more you know, right? So, anyone who tells you that system A is secure is crazy, and no matter what you do. So like the classic example of government level attacks is Stuxnet, which was a worm that was launched possibly by the US and Israel against Iran when they were trying to build their nuclear facilities. And the thing about that was they had physically isolated their computers from the internet. You cannot connect to them from the United States. And that was what they thought they would do to protect their computers. And yet we were still able to get code running on their systems. So there's always a way, there's always a vulnerability, and no matter what you do, if the other side spends enough time and resources, they're going to be able to get you.
How I think we've already determined that we are vulnerable, but how are we compared to other countries in terms of our being able to deal with these issues? And let's face it, we have to know if the other countries are doing it to us, we're doing it to them.
Right. There's no reason to think that we're any more protected than any other country. The internet is pretty open, and we all basically use the same technologies and the same security systems. The thing that makes us more vulnerable is just our reliance on it. So some countries don't rely on the internet for their commerce as heavily as we do, and we don't have as many high-tech companies and that sort of thing. And so if you just shut down the internet tomorrow, I think we would suffer the most just because we rely on it so much, and we don't have any more protections than anybody else. So it kind of makes us uniquely vulnerable.
I've got to take a break now. We're talking with Charlie Miller, who is a cybersecurity expert, and he's with us in studio. We'll take your questions in just a moment. If you have questions for Charlie, we'd love to hear from you. He's not going to solve your computer problems, but if you do have security issues, we'd certainly like to hear from you. Back in just a second, or a minute that is, with Charlie Miller. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again and welcome back. We'll continue our conversation with Charlie Miller on cybersecurity. Charlie, what's the question you get most from people? I'm sure you have, when people know what you do and who you are, that they have questions for you. What questions do you get most frequently?
Right. So I'm a very famous expert, but probably the most common question I get is, you know, why isn't my email working or how do I hook up my printer? So not too many cybersecurity questions do I get.
But people do have security issues and security concerns, more so with each passing year. I mean, I mentioned Schnucks before. That's just the tip of the iceberg.
For sure. So the tough thing about Schnucks or any of these things you hear about when all the credit cards are stolen and all that is it's really difficult from the outside to know what the problem was and who is to blame. So if you think about Schnucks, maybe they did everything perfect. They spent millions of dollars. They had the best team you could imagine, and some hackers still managed to get in. Or maybe they were completely negligent and had no security at all. And from the outside, it's really difficult to tell which of those was the case. And so it's hard to really evaluate that.
Let me take an email here from Barbara A. before I follow up with a question here. Barbara writes, I am most certainly concerned about privacy and sabotage. Besides having a secured email, I don't do Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, anything else. I don't do banking or shopping and keep my browsing to a minimum. When I do browse the web, I immediately rescan my computer to clean up cookies, etc. Personally, if I didn't need the computer to communicate with my volunteer jobs, I wouldn't have it. It's more trouble than it's worth. Well, right. Apparently it is for Barbara.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, she brings to mind the Facebook and the social media things that are out there. Does this increase the potential for people getting into your system?
So with security, there's always this trade-off between security and usability. The most secure computer is, you know, in a concrete block in the bottom of the ocean, but then it's not very usable, right? So if you want to do online banking, then that exposes you a little bit, but it makes your life a lot easier. And so I always try to err on being smart about what you do, but still using all the things you want to use. So if for you social media is something you like, then use it. And I do online banking. I'm on Twitter, right? And I'm just smart about it. So if you use these big services, and you're probably going to be okay, right? If you only surf to very popular websites, you're probably going to be okay. It's when you get into the corners of the internet that aren't quite so heavily patrolled is when you get into trouble. So if you're downloading the latest movie that you're not supposed to download, and or, you know, you're trying to download songs you're not supposed to, that you haven't bought, like, this is when you get into the sites that are more likely to have malware and to target you.
I remember when Napster was the big thing, and that just seemed to feed every computer in the country with some sort of virus or problem.
Yeah, like I said, the more sort of you go towards the illegal sites is the more likely that you're going to run into trouble.
Okay, let's take a couple of phone calls. We'll start with Eric, who wants to go back to our beginning discussion on automobiles. Eric, go ahead. You're on the air with Charlie Miller.
Hey, in view of what you said about automobiles and hacking, considering that the autonomous cars of the future are going to all be communicating with each other so they can space themselves properly, is it possible that some malicious hacker or terrorist in the future could trigger a massive car pileup?
You know, with, like I mentioned earlier, with any technology, there's always the risk that there's going to be vulnerabilities and you know, consequences there. So you have to, you know, as a society, we have to weigh whether the increased attack service by autonomous vehicles outweighs the safety benefits. So, you know, autonomous vehicles, they don't tweet while they drive, they don't drink while they drive, and so hopefully they'll be safer. And then you just have to weigh that against, you know, the possible cybersecurity consequences.
Is it possible, though, that it's one of those things where we won't find out the answer until it's too late, what the risk is?
Well, I think there's already a great risk even with our vehicles now. So, like Chris and I showed with the Fiat Chrysler vehicles, I could remotely scan and I could GPS track. I could, you know, get code running on your car that would make the brakes not work. So we're already extremely vulnerable, and this is something we need to figure out a solution to, not just for autonomous cars, but for the cars we're driving right now.
You know, I would worry less about a massive traffic pileup than I would about airplanes suddenly dropping out of the sky. I assume they're as vulnerable, potentially.
Nobody really knows. So a car is expensive, but I can still buy one and tinker with it, and really that's the truth. So every car company says their cars are safe. Every airplane company says their airplanes are safe, right? The only way to really know is to get people like me poking on them. And we showed that cars aren't very safe right now, at least not the ones we looked at. I don't have access to an airplane, and people like me don't. And so for now, we're just having to take the company's words on it that they've secured these. But if history is any indication, they're probably not any more secure than anything else. Mm.
I heard you talking with producer Alex Hoyer before the program. You were talking about selling vulnerabilities. What is that all about?
Well, these vulnerabilities that are in our products and our web browsers and our phones, you know, they can be used by bad guys, so they're useful to them. They're also useful to the company that made them. Apple doesn't want to have security flaws with their phone, so they're interested in that information too. So the people who discover vulnerabilities have this information, and you've got at least two different parties that want it. And, you know, there's the choice for the person who found it is, do I give it to them? Do I give it to Apple? Do I try to sell it? And so we end up in this situation where there's someone who's affecting the security of all of us, trying to make a decision based on, you know, maybe ethics, maybe money, and who knows. And so it's quite a sticky situation.
Boy, it certainly is. I think most people, if they had that, would probably come down on the side of money. I mean, it could be very lucrative.
Right. It's tough. And it's, you know, you don't know. Like, you know, yeah, I have a great job, but if I'm living in the Middle East, or I'm living in, you know, Eastern Europe, and I'm making $10,000 a year, and someone offers me 10 times that for a vulnerability I found, it's you can't hardly blame the person for accepting that.
You know, it seems, speaking of Eastern Europe, it seems to me that we hear an awful lot about hackers in that part of the world being very successful, particularly in Russia. Why is that? I mean, are they is that a concerted effort on their part, do you think, or do they have very talented people who have figured a lot of this stuff out?
I think it's a combination of they have very talented people, but a lot of countries do. But they have talented people who aren't gainfully employed. So I make plenty of money at my job, so I don't need to go out and hack into banks at night. And they don't necessarily have that sort of financial security. So I think that's a large part of it. Also, there's not the kind of law enforcement there that we have here. So if your home or your business is hacked by someone in Russia, there's not a whole lot that the U.S. government can do to help you. So they can kind of just continue to do that with impunity.
We have a question here from Kelly, who writes, can hackers hack into laptop, iPad cameras and watch you?
I mean, that's scary. There is a history of that. So some of the more paranoid amongst my friends put tape over their camera so that no matter what happens, you don't have to worry about being looked at least.
But we have heard that happens in PCs, for instance, that people can watch their homes that way.
Sure. When the bad guys get malicious code running on your computer, that code can do anything you can do. So if you can turn on your camera, they can turn on your camera.
It also heard that the Chinese, which produce a lot of these picture frames, pictures where you have an automatic slide by of various photos, that they have code written in that sometimes, which can actually eavesdrop on individual households.
So with the picture frames, I think what you're talking about is some of the factories that those were made in had some malware in the machines doing it. And so accidentally some malware got on those. But some of the things that are even more scary than that is a lot of the smart TVs that we have now, they're designed to listen in on what you do and send that home to help, you know, steer advertisements or steer channel selections. I don't know. But that's by design. They're snooping on you, which is really scary.
Well, these are the smart TVs that you can talk to and change the channel and whatever.
Exactly.
But they can also hear the conversation that's going on.
That's how they work, right? They listen to you and they process. They're not smart enough to analyze the voice. So they send that back to a server somewhere.
Okay. So I have one of those, let's say. I don't. But if I did, what could I do to keep that from happening?
I don't know.
You don't know?
Well, I mean, it's designed to do that. So when you purchase that, you've purchased something that is designed to have a microphone to listen to what you say. So, I mean, you could break it. You could, you know, somehow climb in there and turn off the microphone. But for the most part, if you don't want that to happen, don't buy that sort of TV.
Boy, I'll bet the people on the other end have heard some interesting conversations.
I bet. But like Siri works the same way. So every time you tell Siri something on your iPhone, that is sent off to an Apple server that processes that and tries to tell Siri what to do for you. So it's the same thing.
Boy, it gets scary. It really gets scary. The privacy issue is just tremendous.
Yeah, the more you rely on technology and these new great features, the more you're giving up some of your privacy.
Let's take another call. We'll take Brian calling from St. Louis. Brian, go ahead. You're on the air with Charlie Miller.
Hi. Thanks. I was wondering, I'm a networking student right now, and I was wondering what kind of jobs will be emerging from this cybersecurity trend that the world seems to be going into, and what kind of certifications, you know, are people going to be seeking, and how is this just going to sort of change the IT world?
That's a great question, and I think security is a field that will be around for a long time because it's sort of difficult to outsource it. So if you're a software developer, you see a lot of those jobs getting outsourced. Even a network engineer like Brian is a little tougher to outsource because you need someone, you know, plugging in cables and tracing that kind of stuff down. But I think security will be around for a while. And as far as your question about certifications, there are plenty of certifications for security, but none of them are widely accepted in the field. And likewise, there's not really a lot of degree programs, so it's really tough.
Do you know of ISACA?
Say again?
Do you know of ISACA?
No, I haven't heard of that.
Okay, never mind.
Yeah, so most of when you know we're hiring, we mostly look at you know their you know what they've done. So what code have they written? What vulnerabilities have they found? And use that as a measuring stick instead of certifications.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you for the call. Let's bring in Ben calling from St. Louis. Ben, go ahead. You're on the air with Charlie Miller.
Hi there.
Hi, hey, Ben.
Hello. Yeah, hi. Hey, I have a sort of a situation that I've run into before with my bank specifically, and it's, of course, concerned me, and I've talked to them about it, and they just recently stopped using it, but they were using a Java applet for logins, and I wondered what you thought about the safety of that. I personally think it's not safe, but they said, oh, no, it's good to go, so...
Right. I mean, this is one of the things that's tough because it's very easy to say something is secure and it's hard to kind of refute that. But traditionally, Java has been a major source of exploitation against web browsers. So it's if you cannot use Java at all and disable that, it's definitely for the better. That's not to say this bank isn't secure. The one thing I would say if you're worried about the security of your banking your online banking is sometimes banks will support what's called two-factor authentication. And this means that before you log on to the bank, you need your username and password. And then after that, it'll ask you something else. So it'll text you a code to your phone or some other means that you're going to have to prove it to you. So even if a bad guy knew your username and password, they still won't be able to get into your bank. So you might want to be interested in seeing
the thing that I did is I just said, you know, I'm not going to be using because it was only a Java applet if you were logging on from a computer. And so I just didn't do that. You know, I either went to the bank or, you know, whatever.
Right.
An ATM.
Right. And this is a problem everyone has, right? You have to decide whether the convenience of using online banking outweighs the security. And for me, I always, you know, I love the most high tech and the latest, you know, gadgets and technology. So I always sort of err on using the newest thing.
What do you make of the current debate over the backdoor access to some sites for giving the government the opportunity, for instance, to gather information that way?
Right. It's the only political question I actually have an opinion on, I think. So, I think it's a terrible idea to have backdoor access for the government or for anyone else in our infrastructure. So the reason that online banking is safe and, you know, e-commerce is safe is because we have encryption. So you can safely sit in your coffee shop or in your home and not really worry about using that someone's going to snoop on your purchases or your banking transactions. And that's because of encryption. But as soon as you build in a backdoor, whether that's designed for the government or not, that's a way in. And so that means the attackers, that's the first thing they're going to try to get. And there's a history of this. When attackers attacked Google a few years back in something called Operation Aurora, and the very first thing the attackers did was they went into the systems that was used for lawful intercept, which means the systems that the law enforcement was using to, you know, with subpoenas to track various users and stuff. And so as soon as you build in a backdoor, it's a backdoor for everyone, not just the government, but also for attackers.
Right. We only have a little over a minute left. We have a caller we can't take because time doesn't allow it, but he's wondering about, Oliver from Glen Carbon, wondering about the security of VPNs, the virtual private networks.
There's, you know, like anything else, it's possible that there's problems, but I definitely recommend using them. They're an extra layer of protection to stop from snoopers from seeing what you're up to.
What, again, in the lack of time that we have here, what is the best advice you can give the average Joe or Jane out there with regard to their own personal computer security for phones or for tablets?
Yeah, it's tough, but just be smart, right? So if you get an email, you don't know where it's from, you know, don't be clicking on links. And if you get something from your bank, you're not sure it's them, call your bank, right? So just use your smarts and have your guard up.
Would you, in any sense, caution people against doing their banking online?
No. Like I said, I think that you can anything from a major company, you can do it safely. You can make mistakes and run into problems, but for me, the benefit outweighs the risk.
Charlie Miller, I want to thank you so much for being with us. It's a fascinating discussion. It's great to have you back with us again. Don't make it so long next time.
Thanks.
That's Charlie Miller. Coming up, artisanal bread on the rise in St. Louis. Steve Potter and Soundbites next. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.